Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you along today. When we take a look at the health of our lakes, we're going to zero in a little bit on the Madison lakes today, but I think what we see in the Madison area certainly is applicable to your area, wherever you live and whatever lakes you recreate on. Really glad to have a couple of Madison, UW-Madison researchers with us who have been involved in a formal study to look at what is undermining efforts to clean up our water. And I can tell you, in the Madison area and for the Madison lakes, there's been a lot of work over the years, a whole lot of work, and yet we still have issues and problems. And so they were looking at why is that the case, at least to some extent. Dr. Eric Booth, assistant research scientist at UW-Madison in the Department of Agronomy, also in civil and environmental engineering. Good to have you with us today, Eric. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And Adina Rissman is a UW faculty member from the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology, but she focuses on relations between people and natural resources. And Adina, great to have you along as well.
Pleasure to be here, Larry.
And I hope you'll join in as you listen to me visit with these two experts. Maybe you have some ideas or questions about the efforts that have been done to clean up lakes. Have you been involved with lake cleanup where you live? What role should municipalities, for example, play in lake cleanup? Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. That's the title of our Facebook page. Love to have you post there as well. Adina Rissman, let me turn to you first. Talk a little bit about the study and sort of the background on it.
Absolutely. Well, what we started to hear as we started to work on this project is that across Wisconsin, both here in the Yahara watershed, which feeds into the lakes around Madison and eventually into the Yahara River and the Gulf of Mexico, that a lot of people were asking, why haven't we made more progress to clean up the lakes already? And then we started hearing the same question across Wisconsin and really around the world. People are asking this question, why is it so hard to clean up water quality? And so what we did here is a synthesis over the last 50 years that really looks at all the different factors that have made it so hard to clean up the lakes, despite, as you said, millions and millions of dollars of effort and a ton of time on the part of both government and non-governmental actors to try to improve the quality of the lakes.
Yeah, and you know, I was just speaking about the Madison Lakes. I was on my morning jog this morning and looking, you know, at the lake as I jogged along, Eric, and, you know, there's a lot of lake weeds out there already, and I'm thinking, oh, man, well, it's probably a good time for us to be talking on the show, but also a little sad to see the amount that's out there.
Yeah, absolutely. So in water quality in general, you can think about it a lot of different ways. You can look at it from the lake perspective, whether it's recreation, fishing, swimming in a lake, or you could think of it in terms of drinking water. But we're focusing today a little bit more on the surface water resources and what impacts water quality. And so the thing that we focus on when we're talking about surface water quality is this nutrient, phosphorus. And so it tends to be in almost all freshwater systems, it is the limiting nutrient. And that means if you add just a little bit more, you'll see more growth of algae. And that's typically... that's related to water clarity. And when you ask people about what you think of water quality or what water quality means to you, water clarity comes up a lot. You also think of algae blooms. And so we're linking those ideas of water quality to phosphorus here and trying to figure out why haven't we reduced the amount of phosphorus entering our freshwater systems.
And what, you know, why haven't we?
That's a great question. Well, one of the things that we found is that there's been a lot of changes, both in urban areas, the cities that we live in, the farms that we live on, as well as in the weather. And really, factors from all of these systems are making it harder. So we have more urban development, more paved surfaces. Within agriculture, we have more corn and less grass, and we have increasing production of milk and manure. And that's really been a huge boon for the economy of our county and our state, but it also means more manure coming into water systems. On the weather side, we've also seen a real increase in large storm events. And it's these big storms, the ones that, you know, create all of that water running through your yard or running through the street, that are the ones that bring the most soil and the most phosphorus right into the lakes.
You know, having lived on one of the Madison Lakes for a long time, those 100-year rainfalls and events were happening every year almost for a while, or at least every other year. So you're right, it does seem, I mean, it's no longer 100-year. It needs to be redefined.
That's right.
100-year event.
Yeah, and there are efforts to try and update those statistics, and then the trick is to try and get them into planning and into new development. So it's not like it constantly gets updated in the scientific world, and then it automatically gets translated into how do we construct new developments according to those updated statistics. But yeah, so climate is definitely a huge factor here. And it has, as Adina mentioned, it has kind of increased this treadmill that we're on, trying to improve water quality. We're running on this treadmill; it's getting faster and faster, and so it's harder to kind of keep up and improve things.
Well, you know, there have been some things done to sort of help. I know, for example, I mean, you know, phosphorus. If just the average homeowner goes to get some fertilizer for the garden or the lawn, you're not going to find phosphorus in Madison, at least, in the stores. At least not advertised. And I think the only time you really need phosphorus for a lawn, for example, would be if you're starting a new lawn.
Right. There have absolutely been tremendous efforts over the last several decades from many different agencies. Farmers themselves have changed a lot of their ethics and attitudes towards nutrient management. And so we're not saying with this study that hasn't happened. It definitely has happened, and it is helping. It's just other unaccounted for factors are coming into play that makes it that much harder for those other improvements to have an effect.
Yeah.
Right. And that was really one of the puzzles for us, because we've done so much. Farmers have done so much on their farms to do nutrient management practices, to install grass waterways and buffer strips and cover crops and on and on. And so much has been done in urban areas as well, with those stormwater retention and detention ponds that are being built all over, rain gardens people are doing in their yards, and to even improvements in some of the stormwater drainage systems underneath the roads. You know, there's really been a huge number of efforts. And so that was one of the puzzles for us. Why hasn't it resulted in this improvement in the lake itself?
Now, how did your research to find that out? I mean, looking at these studies, how did that help you? How'd you go about it?
Yeah. So, and here I want to also give a lot of credit to Sean Gillen, who was a postdoctoral researcher who really led this paper, couldn't be with us here today. But he and Eric and I pulled from a lot of different data sources to be able to document some of these trends to show how things have been changing in ways that have made it worse for the lakes.
Yeah. So I guess we kind of grouped it into three different categories. So the first one is changes in land use and land cover, and then intensification of agriculture, and finally changes in rainfall. And so the changes in land use and land cover include increasing urbanization. So I think we all realize that Madison has grown tremendously over the last many decades. And so what that does is kind of twofold. It shrinks the agricultural land base, and that's the land base where we can spread manure that we generate. And then it also can lead to problems related to construction erosion, and that can send sediment and phosphorus into our local water resources. And then the other change in land use is related to the type of agriculture. So we tend to have more row crops today as opposed to maybe 30 or 40 years ago. And so row cropping, meaning corn and soybeans, are the dominant ones. And there are good parts of the year where those fields that are growing corn and soybeans during the peak of the growing season are bare. So earlier in the year, they're relatively bare. And there are ways to increase the amount of material on the surface to improve that. But in general, there are large chunks of time where it's bare, and so that increases the susceptibility of erosion. And so then there's intensification of agriculture, which is related to with dairy. And, you know, this has a lot of underlying factors. And you know, dairy production is really driven by demand. And we demand today a lot more dairy than we did 30 or 40 years ago.
Yeah.
And so farming is responding to those changes in demands, which is totally natural, right?
Yeah.
And so we've seen as a consequence of that kind of this localized concentration of manure on larger farms, and it's just becoming more challenging to distribute that manure across a shrinking land base and still reduce the amount of phosphorus that's coming off of that land. And then finally, the changes in rainfall is really critical. And we've seen about an inch increase per decade since the 1930s in annual rainfall. So that's quite
a
bit. And so there's that component. But then as Adina mentioned, there's also increasing frequency of these really heavy rainfall events. And those can really be problematic for phosphorus because phosphorus moves from land to water really sporadically, kind of. It's highly variable throughout the year, and so it's just getting flushed into these surface water resources during big rain events. And so if we have more big rain events occurring, then we're having more phosphorus going from land to water.
Yeah. Dr. Eric Booth, and Adina Rissman, our guest today from the University of Wisconsin, talking about their research relating to water quality in the Madison Lakes and really how that relates. We can talk about how that might relate statewide, certainly, or even nationwide, as a matter of fact. There are different issues that Eric just mentioned, including land use, and including intensified agriculture, including weather changes. Nick in Madison, we'll give you a chance. You can join in, too, by the way, at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Nick, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, thanks for having me. I hope you can hear me out here because I think this is why things are getting worse and we can expect to continue to get worse unless policy changes. We can't get the DNR's help on this because they're controlled now. It's just like the judge ruling that the DNR didn't use simple science on this mega well up northeast part of the state. Two springs ago, I was driving out towards Black Earth. I looked up at this field, and I couldn't believe the amount of manure on it. There had to be 8 to 12 inches of solid waste. We're not talking hay included. It's just solid waste. And it was in the spring, the snow was melting, there was a small lake on top of the field, and I knew that this was going somewhere. So I followed it up half a mile down the road, it went under the highway, and it piled in to the Black Earth Creek.
Yeah.
I took pictures, I took water samples, and I mapped the area. I called the DNR, wastewater, and someone would be sure to call me back. I said, it's very important because this is not good and it can be blocked. No one called back. Hmm. I called the next day. I said, no one called me. This is important. It's still melting. She said, I can't believe no one called back. I'll make sure someone calls you back. No one called me back, and it got colder. And I told her what I had. A month and a half later, I read in the state journal that there's
massive runoff and a fish kill. Yeah, I'm remembering that. And thanks, Nick, for calling. I appreciate your call on this. I can relate to your frustration sometimes of not being able to get rapid results on this, but in some respects, does this speak to some of the findings that you have, not necessarily identifying the DNR, but does it speak to some of the findings that you had in your research?
Yeah, I think it's important to mention here that farmers are under a lot of constraints, and it goes back to what I mentioned about increasing demand for dairy products. And there are tight windows where you can spread manure just due to kind of the logistics of farming. And so I have tremendous respect for farmers and what they have to deal with today. And so it's a question of properly managing manure. And there are absolutely cases where you can have these high concentrations of manure being spread on fields leading to fish kills. And I think it's obviously very important to try and minimize those as much as possible. But, you know, we with this paper, we tried to look at it from a broader perspective, not just the farm level. Mm-hmm. And there's an incredible diversity of farm management out there. But overall in the county, we know that there are fewer farms today as there were compared to decades ago, and those farms are getting larger. Some of them are doing an excellent job at managing manure, but there's still that logistical challenge of how do we manage a lot of manure at these single points and try and spread it as effectively as possible during short windows of time where the climate is cooperating and you have equipment available. So it's a complicated issue, and there's a lot of room where we can improve things, and we have to work with farmers to try and improve that.
Yeah.
I don't know if Adina would like to...
Sure, yeah. I'll just jump in on that also, that I think, you know, given Nick's experience, something to think about is that capacity on the part of our agencies, because as Eric mentioned, a lot of these are complex management issues. I think if we do want to manage them well, we need to ensure that those agencies do have the capacity, that they have the staff and the resources and the experience and understanding to be able to respond effectively to citizens who do have challenges that they're facing.
Thanks a lot again for calling. Appreciate it. Talking about water quality, really some research has been done on historical research done on Madison Lakes, but I think the application there in general across the state is definitely there and real with Eric Booth, assistant research scientist at UW-Madison. He's in agronomy and civil and environmental engineering at UW. Adina Rissman, faculty, a member from Forest and Wildlife Ecology, who looks at the relationships between people and natural resources. Join in with your questions or comments. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Larry Mueller. Cheyenne Lentz, our on-air producer, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Right now, we are taking a look at some research that's been done on what factors affect the quality of our lakes and how do we get our lakes, really in the end, how do we get our lakes to clean them up a bit. And Eric Booth and Adina Rissman from the University of Wisconsin, our guests today. And again, you can join us at 800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Did you find some things in your research, you're looking at, you know, where there were some, you know, differences made in cleaning up on the lakes?
So, yeah, there's definitely a lot of information out there that we tried to synthesize related to conservation practices that have been implemented over the last several decades. And so conservation practices, I mean things like grassed waterways in crop areas, buffer strips, restoring wetlands. And so we've documented big increases in those things being implemented in the watershed. So that's a great improvement related to water quality. And then again, that's part of the we're staying on the treadmill concept.
Yeah.
And also a few I mentioned, there's not great data on it, but the data that is available on fertilizer sales shows a decrease in the amount of phosphorus fertilizer that's been at least sold in the county since about 1980. And I think that's partially this kind of change in farmer behavior, understanding that we don't have to apply as much phosphorus because we do have this buildup of phosphorus in the soil that's already feeding the crops. And then also related to the concentration of phosphorus in the feed that we give to livestock has gone down since the 1990s. And there's been some great research across the state. UW Extension and other UW system schools besides Madison have painted this picture. And so those are two examples of improvements.
Yeah.
One of the ways that people talk about this can sometimes be confusing because sometimes we hear that we are making improvements and then sometimes we hear that we aren't making improvements. And one of the things that's been interesting for me to learn about that is that it depends on how that's measured. So one of the ways that we can look at it is the total amount of phosphorus and sediment coming into the lakes. And that really hasn't improved. But if we look at it more as a concentration, you know, if you think about a bunch of soil in a cup that's all stirred up, if you have a really large cup of water, it's going to look a lot more diluted. But that's, and so that's the same thing here, is that we see that the amount of phosphorus is more diluted of what's coming into to the lakes. But that's because we have more water and from those really big, large rainstorms.
Okay.
Yeah, so more rainfall in general is kind of diluting the amount of phosphorus. So if we were just going to look 30 years ago and say, okay, we're going to hold everything constant and we're going to increase precipitation by this much, we would think that phosphorus would go up. There's a nice relationship between the amount of runoff and the amount of phosphorus being loaded to a lake. We haven't seen that. We've actually seen things level off. And so I think that's a way we can look at improvement. Yeah, right. So from a lake's perspective, it's really the phosphorus load that matters. Yeah. So phosphorus load is not changing at all, but it could be worse because we're seeing this much more rainfall occurring.
Yeah, and well, and frankly, I imagine the level of the amount of the pounds of phosphorus going. So you're saying the pounds of phosphorus going into the lakes doesn't really change that much,
right? Correct.
But part of the reason for that is probably because there's more people out there. I mean, the fact that in Madison, for example, that we're not selling fertilizer with phosphorus in it has to tell me that the amount of phosphorus coming from Madison has dropped significantly.
This is okay. So, so we tried to look at the two different sources, so urban versus agriculture, and there's been a lot of work both at UW and other consultancies or consulting firms around Madison. And in general, it's about 80% of the phosphorus to the Madison lakes is coming from agriculture. So there is this other chunk that's important from the urban sources, and yeah, we have had the phosphorus fertilizer ban, which has been an improvement. The problem is we just don't have the monitoring data to say definitively that it has led to less phosphorus. So it's this gap between monitoring and modeling. So we can model changes, but whether or not that's actually happening is the issue.
And the biggest thing that Madison has done in the urban areas is to not dump our sewage anymore into the lakes.
Right.
You know, it's kind of incredible that we were dumping
back, what, 40s, thereabouts, sometime?
Yeah, so
50s?
It's a long long story, but actually from the city of Madison, the treated wastewater was finally diverted away from the lakes in the 50s.
Yeah.
There were still some upstream communities that were sending their treated wastewater into the lakes. But yeah, prior to that, even in the 19th century, it was raw sewage.
Yeah.
And we, City of Madison and the area, has been at the forefront of wastewater treatments because we've had these lakes that have been affected.
Jocelyn in Sheboygan, thanks so much for calling. What's on your mind?
Yes, good afternoon. I was I disagree a little with what one of your guests said about the runoff, you know, from where that man called in about the manure and all that.
Yeah.
And he didn't mention water quality, but I'm sure that it's a huge problem. But I believe that it's not necessarily before a demand for or higher demand for dairy products. I think it's because they're so greedy that they're making these huge farms where these poor animals are all cramped in and they have no life, and they sold out all the other small farmers because they can't compete. And another thing that nobody mentioned was the pesticides, like Roundup, that's used like water and on all the lawns, which I believe that most lawns should be eliminated and grow wildflowers. And I've seen beautiful architecture of lawns, in the front yards. In magazines, it's just absolutely gorgeous. Plus, it uses so much water. That's what one of the things that's happening in California right now. They're tearing out the lawns.
Comments from... Thank you for calling, by the way, Jocelyn. Eric, comment?
I guess I can talk first about the pesticides. And thanks for your comment, Jocelyn. So the pesticides from is related to our study. They're not contributing to the algae growth issues, and, mm-hmm. and so we really are kind of limited in our discussion here of water quality in relation to algae growth. But certainly pesticides have an impact on water quality, not only in surface water but in groundwater. And I can certainly send more resources related to that, but it wasn't related to our study specifically about. Just manure and farmers in general, it's really not simple as saying, large farms are the problem and small farms are not the problem. There's a wide diversity of how manure and nutrients are managed. And you can point to wonderful examples across the board and other situations where it's not as wonderful. So it's a very complicated question. I think the way I'd answer it is we all need to be part of the discussion of where our food comes from and how we use our land to generate food and increasingly biofuel. So energy comes into this equation. I don't know if Adina wants to add anything else to that.
Sure. I think when we think about agriculture, it's important to think that we're all connected to agriculture through what we eat. From my perspective, here on the UW-Madison campus and here in town, when you look out at the lakes, a lot of people like to go in the summers and look out at the lakes and eat that ice cream cone, and dip their toes into fresh water, and mm-hmm. I think that is a perfect moment to think through how can we make all the parts of the system work together so that we can have ice cream and clean lakes and recognize the role of the consumers. And so we've been trying to get away to some extent from that thinking about the us versus them and the urban and agriculture to think through how we can all kind of be part of those solutions together.
Yeah. That makes sense. Kathleen and Madison, thanks for calling.
Hi. I live next to Warner Park, which has a pretty nice-sized lagoon and a little bit of a beach that's on Lake Mendota. And MATC, I guess they've designed something of an algae sucker and filter system that they're going to experiment with on this summer. And I've kind of, the whole idea of, closing the loop is something I've been curious about. Could you take that algae and, dry it and use it as a biofuel or dry it and use it and turn it into biochar, and then you would have, a fertilizer with all of the stuff that we've polluted it, turning it around and becoming a phosphorus source. Mm-hmm. So that's what I was wondering. Can we do stuff like that?
Yeah. Kathleen, thank you for calling, and let me turn to Eric for
sure.
That.
Yeah, thanks a lot for the comment and question, Kathleen. There are definitely opportunities. I haven't seen any kind of operational system that you describe, but I do know a little bit about the system that the MATC students were working on, and that's more related to improving specific beaches and just getting rid of some of the problematic algae. But I think it's another step that you're asking about is whether or not we can use that algae to send it back onto fields as fertilizer. And I think it's an issue of how to scale that up and turn it into enough quantity to make it worthwhile. But I think it's important to understand that right now in terms of phosphorus fertilizer, we're dealing with it's not an unlimited resource. We're mining phosphorus fertilizer from other countries across the world and sending it here to the United States as fertilizer, and we aren't in control of those sources, and they can definitely lead to geopolitical issues. So I think it is important when we're looking out several decades in the future is how can we harness this phosphorus that is ending up in our lakes, and how can we bring it back up onto the land? It's hard because it's not in a very high concentration in some areas. And so how do you concentrate it, package it, and ship it back up to farmers in a cost-effective way? But I absolutely think there are room for opportunities there.
Yeah, great. Kathleen, thanks again for calling. I want to give Stuart in River Falls a chance. Hi, Stuart. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. I've been working in the agricultural field for a long time, and there seems to be a lot of comments about big dairy and, you know, the neglect that's going on. And, you know, I just want to reassure people that, you know, farmers are at the forefront of this. We're very economically minded. We pay very close attention to, you know, what we put on our fields and how it's going to stay there, because it really is an overall loss if we're not conscientious of what we're doing. There's a saying, we were green before green was cool, and, you know, farmers have been, you know, really the front runners. And as more information comes out, you know, you see a lot of guys that are really adapting the way that they manage their fields and their farms fit a program. Here in St. Croix County, we actually have a nutrient management program that all farms have to come up to, and, you know, there's advisors that come out from the county to make sure that we're not spreading too heavily on certain fields, and, you know, making sure that we're just doing the best that we can with what we have.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Good points. Thanks a lot for calling. Comment from either?
I might mention just that, thanks a lot for the comment, Stuart. Absolutely. There are wonderful things going on by farmers really pushing the envelope on some of these conservation strategies. Specifically in the Yahara watershed, there's a group by the name of Yahara Pride Farms that I think is kind of on that leading edge of developing and implementing new technologies. And some of them include things like cover crops. So that gets at that issue of how do we manage those times of the year where we have bare ground when we're growing corn. And maybe we can put some cover crops on the field to prevent erosion and phosphorus runoff. And other things like vertical manure injection. And so there are definitely a lot of farmers out there that are very interested in these new technologies and really pushing the envelope.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And I think another important question is to make sure, or what are the ways to encourage all farmers to participate? Because we still see that not everybody has a nutrient management plan yet. It's difficult to know if those are all being implemented. And so I think to recognize and give a lot of credit to the farmers who are at that leading edge, and then make sure that all farmers are participating as well.
Well, you know, as Stuart says, I mean, as most farmers are conservative by nature when it comes to, you don't want to spend more money on the land than you need to.
Absolutely.
You don't want to put more fertilizer on and spend all that money on fertilizer than you need to.
Right. Yep, absolutely.
So he's absolutely right about that. Susan in Madison has a comment. Thank you for calling, Susan.
Thanks for taking my call. The state spent quite a bit of money, gave $6+ million to Dane County for a manure digester, and it just backfired. It instead of cleaning the lakes, it actually caused spills and everything. Is there any way of saving that project, tweaking that technique they were using to make it?
Yeah, because we're
sure. Yeah. So thanks for the question. Yeah, there's been a lot of issues with that first digester in Wanakee, and a lot of things have been learned and are being applied to the new one out in Middleton. And I think it's definitely a part of the puzzle in solving this issue, as technologies like digesters. And what they can do is they can potentially concentrate the phosphorus. Now, that's not just the digester. The digester is creating the energy from the carbon and manure. It's a whole other process to remove or concentrate the phosphorus and then apply it in outside the watershed, hopefully, so you can actually remove it from the watershed, or at least put it into a concentration or a ratio between phosphorus and nitrogen that makes more sense for the crops. Yeah, it's unfortunate, all the issues with the first digester, but I've heard a lot of conversations, and I've just went on a tour, actually, of the one in Middleton, and I think there's been a lot of lessons learned that can be applied in the future. But it's not going to be a silver bullet, right? It's going to be a lot of different technologies that are going to be part of solving this.
Yeah, and as you look at, thinking now about the research that you did, Adina, what have you been able to glean from that we can apply and kind of work for improving, you know, what really happens to our lakes?
Sure. Good question, Larry. Well, one of the findings is maybe somewhat challenging, that we've done so much over the last few decades, and yet it hasn't helped to clean up the lakes fully. And a lot of the things that are making it difficult are things that we expect to continue. And so this leads us to a couple of conclusions. One route is to say, okay, we're going to muddle along, you know, with lakes having bad years and better years. Another would be to say, well, if we're really going to try to achieve some of these goals in our lakes, maybe we need bigger changes, more transformational changes even. And that can be, you know, difficult to think about. What could that be in ways that could work for everybody? But those could involve changes in technology. They could involve changes in how we use land. They could involve changes from an engineering perspective, as well as from community involvement and thinking about the role of government. So there may need to be a variety of things that change if we're actually going to clean up the lakes.
Yeah,
and that's a good lead into another part of the project we're working on, is looking at scenarios of the future all the way out to 2070. And I like to think of it as this study leads in nicely to that part of our project, because we've developed these four scenarios of the Yahara watershed and what it could plausibly look like all the way out to 2070, to start some of these conversations about long-term change and how can we get what we want out of the land while still preserving the things that we value related to water quality and quantity.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's all part of the Water Sustainability and Climate Project.
Yeah, funded by the National Science Foundation.
And I believe we have on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, I think we have, Cheyenne, a link to that research. Yeah, we do have a link to your study.
Great.
And your paper. So if anybody wants to go on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, they can get a copy of it or look at it. Where else can people go for some more information?
Well, we have more information about the scenarios Eric was mentioning on our webpage, Yahara2070.org.
Yahara2070.org.
Correct.
We can post that up on our Facebook. Yeah, Cheyenne's got it. We'll put it up on our Facebook page as well.
And if people want the nitty-gritty of the research publications, I also have that on my webpage. So people can search for me, Adina Rissman.
And Rissman is R-I-S-S-M-A-N.
It sure is.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us today. That was a big study, and sounds like it's something that's going, hopefully will lead to down the road improvement in our lakes. And I appreciate having you with us.
Thanks so much. Thanks. For having us.
Thanks. Yeah, very much.
Appreciate it very much. Eric Booth, assistant research scientist at UW-Madison. He's homes in the Department of Agronomy and the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering. Adina Rissman, from the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology, faculty member. She focuses on relations between people and natural resources. That was great. Well, I'm sure this is a topic we're going to continue to look at and study, and it was great to have them here to really talk with us about it. And we'll keep track of what's going on with it. Coming up next, we're going to take a look at biking. Have you gotten on your bike yet this year, or have you been doing it for a long time? What about safety? Arthur Ross, our guest, coming up next here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.